Welcome to the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best doubles strategies to improve your game and win more matches. I'm your host, Will Bocek. This podcast, my website, and my weekly newsletter all focus on the goal of better understanding the sport of doubles and helping players like you improve faster through actionable advice that you can use in your very next match. My goal is to provide the best doubles strategy resources in the world. And to do that, I study, analyze, and work with players at every level of the game, all the way up to the ATP and WTA tours. If you enjoy this podcast, I've created double strategy products that go even deeper if you want to take your doubles knowledge to the next level. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about them, or if you want to learn more now, go to thetennistribe.com/products. Here's today's episode. In this episode, you're going to hear my conversation with Sophie Chang from the ATX Open. Sophie is number 82 on the WTA Tour in doubles. She made the third round of the US Open in 2023 with Alicia Parks. She has 21 ITF doubles titles. And in Austin, she lost in the first round in a very close match to the top seeds, 7-6, 7-6, with her partner, Angela Kulikov. And we talk a little bit about the match, and there was really two things that I noticed when I sat courtside and watched them play. Number one was Sophie is always smiling. She has a very positive attitude, so we talk about that, why we think that that helps her on the court. And then I also noticed that they play two back on Angela's second serve. So she talks about why they started doing that and why they think that it helps their game. And it's definitely something that I feel like you can kind of take away strategically for your own game, depending on your doubles partner and the opponents you're playing against. We also talk a little bit about her singles career. So she's still kind of balancing this doubles and singles career where her rankings are not really even. So she has to kind of figure out how to manage that schedule. We also talk about process versus goals. She really doesn't focus on goals too much, which I found pretty interesting. And then she shares some advice for playing big points. And this answer really surprised me. She focuses on something that, if you've listened to the podcast for a while, I actually recommend you never think about during matches. But she kind of reframed this for me in a different way. And it's something that I look forward to trying next time I go out and play in my next doubles match. And then at the end, we, of course, talk about how to make doubles more popular. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Sophie is one of those interviews where you can tell that she puts a lot of thought into each answer. She has a great personality and is really, really thoughtful with all of her answers to my questions. So I think you're going to become a fan after listening to this. And without further delay, enjoy my long conversation with Sophie Chang. All right, we're here with Sophie Chang at the ATX Open. Sophie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
So yesterday you lost a close match, 7-6, 7-6. And one thing I wanted to start with was there was a specific point, but you did this kind of throughout the match. I think it was Angela's serve, and y'all are down 15-30, and you missed an easy volley, and y'all went down 15-40, and it was a big game. I don't remember specifically the game score, and you turned around and just smiled, and you kind of sarcastically like had some like hand motions or something. Is that something that you've always had, or is it something you've trained yourself to be like really lighthearted, or talk a little bit about that?
I think by nature, I am pretty lighthearted in most things in life. Like I'm pretty laid back, chill, kind of. Those are the words I would use, but I've always kind of had a naturally smiley face. So I know I come across like that, but I've had a history of having a little temper only in tennis because it means so much to me, obviously, you know, now it's my career and stuff. So I'm sure if you asked my coach and stuff that question, he'd be like, no. But I think the more that I find, like, the more I can keep, you know, my big goals and dreams about this career in their place and make it about, like, things I can control and stuff, and kind of break down the game into a way that where I can trust the process, that natural kind of happiness, if you will, mm-hmm. definitely I've found comes out more, you know, in everything I do on court, which I love. I think it, you know, helps me play better, stay loose, and also it just makes this whole career more enjoyable.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And I guess part of the process of just playing tennis is missing easy shots.
Yeah.
It just, like, happens. Yeah. So, like, you might as well laugh about it. I think it's a great outlook.
Yeah. I think usually if it's a error that I, you know, as long as I know in my mindset, like, if I make an error, I know I can correct it, or I know I did the right thing maybe, or mm-hmm. I just have a plan in place, like, okay, I'm going to get after it the next time and try to do better, then it's very easy for me to just kind of let them roll off, you know.
Uh-huh. Do you have that same mindset when you're playing singles, or do you feel like you take it a little more kind of seriously?
Yes.
And you're a little more hard on yourself maybe?
No, I always had a tendency to probably be harder on myself in singles because I tend to lean that way more, of being placing the blame always on myself or things that I did wrong, and kind of coming down on myself a little more negatively than what is necessary. And then so doubles always kind of helped me a little bit with that, because you have obviously someone out there with you who's on your team, but also hopefully is a good friend of yours, and you're kind of in it together. So that naturally always made it a little easier for me to laugh things off in doubles. But in singles, I feel I've come a long way. And again, it comes down to, like, if I get myself into that right headspace before the match and I know what I'm working on, I know I'm getting better and I trust the process, then I stay pretty laid back in singles as well. Mm-hmm. Or I try to.
Yeah.
I shouldn't speak too soon. We'll see. We'll see whether any rackets go flying next week.
So yesterday, like I said, it was a close match, 7-6, 7-6. I wanted to dive into the strategy a little bit, but what did you think of the match overall?
Mm-hmm. Obviously it was a heartbreaker to lose it when it was that close, and I felt like we had definitely some opportunities in both sets. I think specifically what I'm remembering is I think I was serving for the set in the second set, at least, you know, to, so, like, that's always really tough, you know, when you look at that aspect of a match like that. But I definitely did not, I left the court feeling pretty encouraged still, because I felt like I did a lot of good things that I wanted to on court. And again, I tried to keep the focus mostly on that. Like, I thought perhaps I had a few more errors in the first set on my end, and I felt like I corrected a lot of them, you know, like I needed to get a little lower on some returns and started making more of them once I did that. And also worked through some things at the net when I was playing net, because obviously if anyone's seen us, Ange and I play doubles. Ange is more of the net player and I'm more of the baseline player. But we've been working definitely on our, you know, a little bit on each of our weaknesses in that regard to, you know, make us more dynamic and well-rounded. So, again, like, I felt like there was some improvements made on my end. Like, I got some good poaches and created some aggressive volleying situations on my end, which was, I was really happy about. I think the only thing I kind of noticed was, or I walked away a little unsure of, was my double faulting a little bit more. You know, I felt like, you know, if I had done the exact same match and not had some of those double faults, we would have at least made it to a third set, or, mm-hmm. you know, been in there. So that was maybe one of the things that I had a little more of a neutral to negative, response to when I was walking away. But I try to keep it pretty focused on my process and my progress as a player.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, like, the wind or the cold had anything to do with some of the double faults? It was a lot windier yesterday.
It was definitely tough serving conditions, and there were some double faults from, I think, most of the players.
Yeah, I noticed a lot.
Not as many as me.
Well,
but But, you know, I've always been a more aggressive player in a bigger server. So hopefully, you know, I get some free points back, you know, if I'm sure. hitting some double faults. But the balls here, I feel, are pretty heavy, the ones we're playing with at this tournament. Mm. And the wind does not ever make it easy, and it was colder, so, you know, that also makes the balls not travel as fast. So, you know, some of my service errors were on kick serves, which, you know, and some of them didn't, like, they went in the net, which, you know, obviously with the cold and the wind and the heaviness of the balls, like, that would make sense playing a role.
Yeah. So you mentioned Angela's more of the net player. One thing I wanted to ask about is the two back on her serve. So it's something that I rarely see at the pro level. Mm-hmm. Club level players, I recommend it a lot, especially if there's like a super weak net player.
Yeah.
But most of y'all are all so good at the net that you don't see it a whole lot. But can you explain the thought process behind it and why you do that?
Yes. I can do my best.
Explain it in Angela's words and then your words and then her words.
Well, it's funny because we started doing that when we were within one of our first two or three tournaments that we played together, and it was on the ITF circuit. And I should say, like, when I have always felt really comfortable actually at the net when I'm starting on offense more, you know, and I used to play with another girl who's taller than me and, like, you know, had a really big serve, you know, like, possibly hit bigger than me a lot of the time, you know, from the ground. And so I was kind of more of the net player, like, in that circumstance. But I think my neutral to defensive volleying skills, that's where I'm a little uncomfortable. I don't feel like I feel like I'm telling my secrets here. I don't feel like sometimes I'm as natural at covering court at the net, you know, like from a more neutral to defensive position at first, you know, to gain the advantage. So, sometimes on the second serve return, like, especially at the WTA level, these girls are, like, amazing returners and stuff.
Yeah.
And it just – and then Ange also is so – she's a great baseliner, but she's so formidable at the net that we just kind of discovered, like, if I start at the baseline, I can cover three-quarters of the court. I play singles. You know, I'm completely comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. And she can get to net, you know, like, and it's hard to, you know, obviously serve and volley on a second serve sometimes, but she has less court to cover. If I'm at baseline, I can't cover all that court when I'm at the net, even if I feel my hands are good or whatever, you know. So that was kind of the idea, was that she'd hit the second serve and we'd take away an easy target, you know, like, to try to get it past us while she can get up to net, and then we can be in the position that we want to be in, you know.
Mm-hmm. That was really well articulated. Okay. I think you're undercrediting yourself for your doubles knowledge.
I don't know. But it was definitely, yeah, like, it was something I just came up with it at the time. Like, I didn't come up with it because I could put it into those words at the time. I just was like,
let's try.
I think we were playing big hitters on a clay court, and I was nowhere near getting these returns that were coming back to me, and I was like, I'm just going to stay back, you know. And then it worked, and then we realized why it was so good. So then
I would imagine on clay it's even, like, more so.
Yeah, it was
the ball just kind of sits up on the second serves. So they ran a lot of I formation against y'all yesterday. I felt like it was 80-90% of the time.
Yeah.
It was a ton. How do you handle that? How do you think about returning against the I formation?
Should I keep going? Or?
go ahead. It's fine.
How do I feel returning
against the I formation?
Yeah. I am a big advocate for because as a returner, I feel very comfortable returning always, you know, I love returning, but, even though, you know, obviously people think about my serve and they're like, oh, you should serve first and stuff. I used to always be a person that was like wanted to return first, 'cause that was like one of my favorite shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it just kind of adds a little bit of discomfort into the whole returning mix, you know, when you know you have this person in the middle of the court and you don't know which way they're going to go. That being said, you know, I feel comfortable enough most of the time that I think it helps, you know, my singles play, and, you know, the fact that I still play singles is helps me at least, you know, be comfortable returning in those situations. But I also, again, one of my strengths as a player is my kind of natural power on returns. And so sometimes at least I do feel comfortable enough that if I can just strike a clean ball, I don't have to worry as much about where they're going, you know, like that it's more about the quality
it's
of the shot.
Be a really tough volley anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes too, like if I, you know, I don't even necessarily pick a target, you know, like I'll either go instinctually or I'll go middle, because at least that cuts out most of their angles that they can get, you know, it's not like I'm going to like hit through middle and win the point on that, but at least sometimes I feel like that will just, you know, it will, they'll maybe hit the volley, but we can get back in the point that way.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of players I talk to, and you see it like, the returner's partner will signal and say like line or cross.
Yeah.
But then a lot of players like to use that instinct and feel like, okay, if it's into my body, I need to come across my body more, or if I'm stretched, like, I got to get line. So it's interesting hearing like how different people handle it differently.
I think I've played, you know, with different partners, and some do like to signal that more, and some have asked me to signal it for them, you know, when they're returning.
Sure.
And then some don't. And I think, especially, so for Ange and I, like, when she's at the net and I'm at the baseline, we kind of play those two positions pretty similarly. We're both very instinctual. So we haven't ever usually signaled for that scenario. And yeah, honestly, that is kind of how I play. Again, you know, as an aggressive player, is I usually am focused more on executing my shots than you know, playing in the confines of like I have to go to a certain target, you know, because if I see something, I always feel confident that I can do it. So I tend to not signal that or go for that. I tend to usually just play off the ball.
Yeah, I mean, from talking to so many people about it, I really don't think there's like a right answer or right way to do it. Like with some stuff there is, like you should definitely be doing this instead of this. But in this case, I do think it's like very player specific and what you're comfortable with as a individual and a team.
It's funny because I had a tough time recently. I was playing with a girl and she wanted me to signal for her because it really helped her. Return. Okay. And I kept forgetting because I could not remember that, like, okay, every time we're in she wants to have like that signal.
Oh, shoot.
And I felt so bad. She finally just stopped asking for it. She was really nice about it. But I just could not remember for the life of me, because I would be up at net being like, okay, I'm getting ready. And I didn't remember that I was supposed to signal.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, that's tough because you can't like say, oh, hold on, server. Hold on between your first and second
server. Where am I
supposed to return? So talk a little bit about, you're still playing singles as well. How do you balance the singles and the doubles? Your singles ranking, I believe, is 352 looked at this morning, and then doubles, you're up in the top 100.
It is very difficult. It hasn't been easy. I think, you know, my doubles was always a little higher than my singles, but not high enough that it was like, I was never playing a whole different set of tournaments for doubles. And that was all the way up until I met Ange and we had some really good results in doubles. And that was when we cracked top 100 together. And at the time though, my singles ranking was around 250, I believe. And so close to like quality range for most of those tournaments. And that was in 2022. And I remember that getting to the end of that year, I was really hustling to try to make, you know, try to get my ranking up to, you know, quality's range of slam so I could be playing both. And I did it. I didn't take a preseason in 2022. I went and played in Andorra and Dubai in December. So I only had 2 weeks off after that, and then went out to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And, but I did exactly what I needed to do. I was like the one of the three last ones into qualies of Australian Open. It was a great experience. I had my best result in singles in a slam there, and almost qualified. But it was kind of sad because at that time, you know, I had started that last year, I started 2022 playing a 25K, you know, mm-hmm. at non-slam and won it in singles. And I was defending 50 points and I got 30 for almost qualifying at the Australian Open, which was really hard, mm-hmm. and dropped, you know, then out of slam range again in singles. And so this whole last year in 2023, I was trying to, you know, see if I could play both and get my singles ranking up into that range that would let me play the same tournaments for both and benefit from the rankings. And, you know, I just didn't quite have at least my singles game together, I feel, at the time to be successful at that. But I played a crazy year. I played 35 tournaments last year, and that's mm-hmm. without taking a preseason in 2022.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. You know, that was too much, you know, like, you know, I'm pretty hardy, like, injury wise. So I didn't, you know, by the end of the year, my body did kind of break down a little bit, but, that's a really unsustainable schedule, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's been a really hard, like, process of decision making of, you know, which tournaments to play and, you know, how to balance the two. But I'm so, like, I love both and I love playing both, you know, at mm-hmm. events. Like, I'm a player that, like, I feel so complete when I'm in both draws and playing two matches a day. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard for me to, like, give up one, but it, you know, it hasn't been great, obviously, for my singles ranking, especially, you know, having that drop into the 300s and stuff. But I don't know. I'm still hopeful that, like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I have to make some decisions about scheduling, but if I keep focusing again on my own improvements and playing the tennis that I believe I can play, that, you know, at some point it's going to pay off and I will be able to get, like, the rankings up, both of them, into a range that I'd want to be at, you know?
Yeah. Do you have any specific goals in mind for this year, or, like, kind of targets you want to reach, or plans mm-hmm. on managing both?
Yeah. I don't usually set ranking goals or anything. Again, more process goals. Mm-hmm. I would love to get my serve percentages up a little bit, because, number one, I think that's really important for both of my games, like, you know, just my own ability to understand my serve and find my rhythm always, you know, and again, first serve percentage and second serve percentage. You know,
so you're talking about make percentage,
like, make percentage. Yeah. Okay. Because I mean, obviously, you know, when I make them, you know, like, especially my first serve, it's got a good pace to it. Yeah. So, obviously I always want to hit it bigger because that's fun. Yeah. but, you know, right now, like, I know that will help me win a lot of these close matches that I haven't quite pulled through. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, it helps the longevity of my tennis playing abilities to keep it shorter points, you know, like,
for sure.
Especially for my game style. I like short points. So that's a big goal for me, if I had to pick one, is, you know, like, going after those serve goals and getting those percentages up, I think, you know. But yeah, I don't usually pick ranking goals as much, because I just kind of feel like that's, you know, I trust that will come with my level. Mm-hmm. More, yeah.
Do you track a lot of your stats?
Probably not as much as I should or okay. I could.
But yeah. You're looking, like, after each match at your serve percentage
I mean, yeah, but usually I know. Like, I'm like, okay, this is a 30% serve, no, or like a 40%. I think one, actually, this was in Rome, Georgia this year. I knew I had a really bad serving match, but somehow won the match. And this was indoor hard. Mm-hmm. But it was in three sets. You know, it was very long. And I did go back and look at, I knew I was getting ready for doubles, and I was like, man, I must have had, like, a lot of double faults, my service percentage must have been pretty poopy. And I think, I can't remember what my serve percentage was, but I had 18 double faults.
Oh, shit. But you won the match.
I won the match, and I only had 9 aces. Like, so that's not a good, you know, ratio. but because, you know, I've had, I think I've played a match once where I had, again, like upwards of 18 double faults, but I had like, you know, in the teens at least of like aces 15, as well, you know, so that's good. You know, or not good, but it's better. But I think, sorry, wait, what was your, I was tracking stats. Yeah. And another one, I think, yeah, usually I have a picture in my mind of kind of what happens out there. So sometimes I'll know those stats a little bit.
There was I can't remember who it was, but it might have been on the podcast, but there was a coach I talked to at some point in the last year, and he told me that he was tracking first serve percentage for one of his players. And I think maybe they had a disagreement or something. I don't remember, but he said for like a month or 2 months or something, they decided to track the first serve percentage. And then also before the player got to see it, they'd ask him after the match, what do you think your first serve percentage was? And see how close it was to the actual number.
Okay. Yeah.
And like they would track it over the course of a month or so. And they happened to underestimate it most of the time. They said it was not far. It was like maybe 3%, but on average, like they slightly underestimated it.
Yeah.
So you might try that.
I know. I think I probably underestimate mine, you know, sometimes too. Like I'll come out and I'll be like.
But you could just have a little journal and like it, you could figure that out if you underestimated or underestimate it.
No, definitely.
That would be interesting to see. If you do that, report back and let us know.
We'll do.
What about like the next like month or two? What's your schedule look like?
Right now, I'm supposed to go to Dominican Republic either tomorrow or the next day, and I'm going to play singles there, maybe doubles. It's a 25K. Again, like great competition there, and like I want to play doubles, you know, like always because I love doubles. But like, you know, it is a situation where it's like, ooh, even if I did do really well and win that whole doubles tournament, it's not going to help my doubles ranking at the time. But that's, you know, it's always good to have points to defend points if you're losing them, you know, so I'm considering it, you know, I'll play either one or two events there. But definitely for singles, you know, that's why I'm going there. But there's 2 weeks back to back, but I could come back and maybe play. I'm trying to decide right now whether I'll come back and play the Charleston 125 for doubles. I won't make singles there. And then I believe I have it written out somewhere. I can't remember exactly what's next. I might have a week off or 2 weeks off and then be, maybe I think the Bogota, the Charleston 500 week is coming up, I think, soon after that, or I don't know.
Charleston's just after Miami.
Yeah.
So okay. It's like the first week of April.
It might be like I might be starting that week, and then there's a bunch of kind of higher level ITFs in the States that I'm looking to prioritize playing there quite a bit.
Okay. What about, so today you're going to practice indoors, luckily, since it's 40 degrees outside, with Catherine Harrison, and she's focused on doubles for the most part, I believe. What do your practices look like right now? Are you mostly focusing on, like, baseline single stuff, or are you doing a combination, or does it depend on who you're hitting with?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on who I'm hitting with and what tournament I'm getting ready to play. Obviously, I'm switching from doubles to singles right now, so I'll definitely be more focused on just getting back in the singles, making sure I'm in the singles rhythm of movement. But I tend to mostly practice singles because usually if I'm feeling good and on the singles court, then that carries over more directly to doubles, you know, for me. With the exception of like, I always kind of put in that extra work a little bit, I think on volleys, you know, and stuff because more, you know, more so than I would in singles, because I think it actually, that could be a good addition more to my singles game too, if I'm more willing to come in sometimes or serve and volley or close out some points at the net, but mostly I do win points from just being an aggressive baseliner. So that's usually kind of what I'm practicing in the single scenario.
But what about today specifically with Catherine? Do y'all have like a plan going into it, or will y'all get there and just kind of talk and hit some?
Sometimes, I mean, we don't, okay. When I'm practicing with another player, we don't usually communicate like before the practice, like, hey, what do you want to work on? Like, can we do this or that? Unless someone really wants something, you know, done. I mean, I think the standard at these tournaments is usually like warm up, hit all the strokes, and then go into points, you know, usually. But I usually, and I think probably other players too, have like things running in their mind of what they want to work on. And then someone will get there to the practice, say, if I want to, like, if I'm like, hey, I want to hit a few extra volleys, or can you do a little bit of movement with me where, you know, you move me around a little? Like, if there's something like that, we'll say that to each other, usually at the beginning of the practice. Also, if it's like a practice like this where it's between tournaments, you know, and it's not like we're getting ready to play the next one yet, you know, necessarily. That's when I think we'll get more of those requests, and they're like, oh, I want to do the specific drill, or I want to do more of the specific shot. And then if, like, say once I get to the Dominican Republic and I'm practicing the day before my match, no one usually asks for those types of things. Usually from the players, it's just like warm up, play points.
Okay. That makes sense. So I think I mentioned this before the, before we started recording, a lot of the listeners are club level players, right? Do you have any, so this month we're focusing, or for the next like 6 weeks, we're focusing on kind of mindset and the mental side of the game. Do you have any tips for playing well under pressure or playing good in tiebreakers?
Well,
anything that's worked for
yesterday, yesterday didn't work very well.
Other than yesterday.
We lost two tiebreakers yesterday. No.
We'll forget about yesterday.
I've had a pretty decent record in tiebreakers, I think, if you count over my career in doubles. But, and I do take a lot of the deuce-ad points, and I like to take it. So I think I usually... I know it's such a big question. For playing pressure points, like if you're talking like a deuce ad point or a match point or like that one individual point, for me, I usually feel confident. Number one, if I know my shit out there, you know, like I know. Like I have a set, you know, a couple, like your one plan. Or two set, you know, cues that work for me. It could be different for every player. As I said, I'm very execution based on my strokes. So usually it looks like for me, I'm like, okay, on this return, I know I'm going to, you know, get my hips turned quickly on the return, you know, either side. Like I'll be like in my ready position. I'm like, I'm ready, like forehand, I'm going to turn like this, back, I'm going to turn like that, you know, or something like that. Or I'm going to make sure that I stick it through contact, you know? So something really simple like that, that I know has been working for me and making my shots go in the court, you know? Cause then when I can kind of lean into those cues for me, that's like, I just, it's like, I can almost have something to exaggerate, and that's really helpful for me to like have, you know, output like any nervous energy I have. It's like, I'm just going to do these things that work for me. I'm going to do them like the best I can, like on this point.
So these are like physical cues
for me. I'm more like that. Like there's other players that I think might lean into more of a, like a strategy based one. Like they might say like, okay, no matter what, I'm going to take, you know, my strokes inside, you know, inside strokes, like, cause that's my highest percentage. Or they might know, I'm going to, you know, like maybe someone favors a chip or like, you know, they might say like, I'm going to throw up a lob cause I know that, you know, this player's in eye formation up in that, or, you know, or whatever. So that, you know, I think overall, like if you have something that you know you're comfortable with and you know you do well, like leaning into that, like on the big points, it's like that is, that's what I've seen has the best results. It's also more fun that way, like usually because There is like kind of a confidence and a mindset that you want to take into those points that you're like, I'm ready to win this point, you know, because mm-hmm. most of the time, the more free and aggressive player will, or not aggressive, but the more free and confident player will win that point, you mm-hmm. know, like, or will have the advantage in that point.
Sure.
And so if you're leaning into something that you're really comfortable with and you're like almost kind of proud of, you know, like, this is what I do on court.
Yeah.
it's like, then you kind of get that mindset more of like, oh, it's showtime. Like, this is what we play for. We got the big point. I'm going to do my strength, you know, mm-hmm. and it's actually really fun, you know, and then you kind of go, that's kind of switched for me, like from going from the mindset of more like, oh no, I'm scared of this big point. I don't want it, to like, oh, I want this. I want to play, you know, like, I want to show what I can do on this point, you know?
Yeah.
tiebreakers, there's more points, you know?
Yeah.
In the, like, it's a procession of points, obviously.
Sure.
I think usually before every tiebreaker, this is something my coach in Maryland always told me that stuck with me from the very beginning, is like, especially in a 10-point breaker, but, you know, in any tiebreaker, it's like, most of the time when you get into a tiebreaker, whoever wants it more is going to have a big advantage. So I definitely try to do a check-in, like, before every tiebreaker, that's like, okay, you know, no matter what, like, I'm never gonna, you know, I'm not gonna let anything bother me. I'm just gonna fight for every single point. You know, I'm not gonna give anything up in that department. And, mm-hmm. you know, that always has worked well for me.
Yeah, so like raise the intensity for like the short 2 to 3 minutes.
You can't, like in a tiebreaker, it's like you can't, if you make a mistake, you can make mistakes, but if you let it bother you, then you've made another mistake. And that's already like a quarter of the tiebreaker. You know, you have to be really on your mental sharpness out there. Like, okay, you know, I miss one. Okay, what am I going to do to make it better this next time?
Yeah, 1 point at a time.
Yeah.
So 2 more questions for you, and then I'll let you go. So you mentioned before we started recording that Angela has taught you a lot on mm-hmm. the doubles court. What is maybe 1 to 3 things, like big takeaways that you've learned from her over the years mm-hmm. on the doubles court?
So many things. I think definitely seeing the geometry of the court and being able to see, like, to focus, because in doubles, you know, there's 2 players on the court, so it limits options more. I came into our partnership, the doubles duo, with being kind of just like this big hitter that just was always like, see ball, hit ball, you know? And I got away with it a little bit because I do, you know, hit a high-paced ball, you know, but there were things, you know, adjustments in the geometry of the court, I'd say, like, where she was like, hey, if you go here, you know, like, if you don't make the shot perfectly, then we're both in trouble. But, or if you go here, even if you don't make the shot perfectly, it's okay, I can cover you, you know, like, yeah. little things like that. Mm. So that was one. I think 2 is...
How did she show you that? Was it, like, in practice, she would, like, kind of illustrate it on the court, or... Did she like write it in a notepad with a court?
She did all of those things.
Okay.
She'd kind of constant. It was through one thing that I always loved about our partnership is we would just spend hours like talking about things, you know, on the court and being passionate about like learning and, you know, together and stuff. And I think that was really special. It was really special times. And so she would always, when we would talk about it, that would like, you know, like just kind of explore ideas of like 2 people talking about mm-hmm. our games together. I would soak in that kind of knowledge from her because she was always coming at it from that angle.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, then when I'd ask more questions, she'd either, she's shown me on a notepad before. She's also shown me on the court. She's probably drawn it in the clay before, drawn a court in the clay and been like, look, you're here, I'm here. Yeah. Look at this. This doesn't make sense.
That's good.
But yeah, I think that was one thing. Let's see. As I said, like that play of like me being back and her, you know, like on her second serve and her coming mm-hmm. up, like that type of thinking, I would say, you know, like,
again,
this was something that I actually happened to just blurt out, but it was, when I said it, I thought it was just going to be like a one-time thing for that day. And I was think my mindset was more like, well, I need to learn how to volley better. And, you know, like that's the problem. So you know, we'll play this match, and since I can't volley today, I'm going to stay back, but then I'm going to learn how to volley, and then it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, like, she's definitely opened, broadened my scope a little bit of that, like, yes, I can learn how to volley, and I can keep working on defensive volleying and being comfortable up there, but that's never been, like, what made me, you know, special as a player, you know, is my aggressiveness from the baseline and my serve, you know, that's mm-hmm. more my, that's always going to be more my strength. And for her, she, yes, she can feel so comfortable at the baseline and be an amazing baseliner, but she, her, like her X factor is her volleys. So mm-hmm. like just kind of broadening that, like you don't have to just try to be the best at everything mm-hmm. to be, you know, one of the best in the world. You just, you kind of want to know what your strengths are and play to your strengths.
Yeah.
I think that's helped me in singles too, like that type sure. of mindset. So that's one thing as well. And then, she, okay, this is a very specific thing compared to the other two.
Okay.
And now I'll notice it in people, like if I help my coach teach any doubles clinics or things like that, when when I was at the net and my partner's at the baseline, I was always kind of taught or under the impression that my eyes would be just like straight ahead and like looking at the baseliner mm-hmm. in front of me. And she kind of taught me that you can get a cue of whether, when you can move forward and be aggressive on the volley, if you look at the other volleyer, because as soon as you see that they don't cross to take a ball, then you can move it. You know, you don't have to be waiting to cover that. And you know, that sounds really silly, but I didn't know that. And it was like a game changer for me to be able to, it was something I had to learn because I was so used to just always kind of looking straight ahead and then waiting to move off of you know, when my opponent struck the ball. But then
that's great advice.
That was one.
You can kind of mirror that other net player. So if they start to coach, you kind of mirror them and like come backwards with them so you can defend better.
Like if you think, if you're not sure whether they're going to take the volley yet, you can, you know, you can look at, be looking at them and be waiting closer to the service line to cover that middle. But then as soon as they don't, you move in.
Yeah.
Get aggressive.
No, that's not obvious at all. I think most, I would say most club level players don't do that at all. Mm-hmm. And then even out here, like I've been watching for that specific thing the last few days and not everybody's doing it. Like, even at this WTA 250 tournament, like, some of the players are not looking at the other net player. Like, they're looking at the baseline.
I mean, and I still forget sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be like, what was I doing? I wasn't even looking at that.
It takes a conscious effort for sure. But it's so helpful once you start to do that. So, last question. How do we make doubles more popular?
Let me think about this one for a second, because that's a good question, and I think there's a lot of options and opportunity for that. I just want to think about like some of the best ways off the top of my head. I think marketing it is really important, obviously. Like some of the other players and I have definitely talked about like how much the social media marketing on pickleball really expanded that sport really quickly. Like, because again, I'm not even a big sport. I'm not like my Instagram feed, like the the stuff I look at on Instagram are really silly memes and things like that. And I remember when pickleball was taking off, somehow that was like all over my feed and I never interacted with any of those posts or liked any of them. And I you couldn't get away from it. You know, there were like things, you know, and maybe some of them were more cheesy and they were on TikTok, which I don't know much about TikTok, or some of them were very entertaining stuff or like kind of hyping up the pickleball points and stuff. But I respect that. Like it made it look, you know, like a video that people wanted to click on, you know, whether it was like the headline or the title of the video or the caption or, you know, something like electrifying point, you know, stuff like that. But I think like just kind of, I mean, that's the first thing off the top of my head I would say is like social media and marketing it, like, you know, doing interviews with these doubles players, like getting to know them, you know, like showing their personalities, showing the really fun points you get out of doubles, you know, like, cause like even if you were at a match yesterday, there were some crazy points in there that we had, you know, that you can't get in singles
you
as
don't.
Much.
Yeah.
And I'll talk to people. Like I can't tell you, like every week at any club I play at that has members, you know, that are there watching, most of the time, like if I mention that I play doubles or I'm there playing doubles, they're like, oh, you know, like I like watching doubles better than singles. Yeah. And I know that's not for everyone, but like, you know, I think it is different. Like it's a different style of game. And it's, I think there is a large fan base that are really interested in those doubles points. It's faster. It's like really quick. You got two people on the court. There's more things that can happen. Mm-hmm. So like, I think just opening up that, I don't know, like that media for it, like, as I said, like showing more doubles and then showing points of doubles on social media or places where people are looking for it, you know, whether it's highlights on TV, you know, like, I don't know. Again, I don't know much about the sports world being a professional athlete, you know, as much as I should have, but like wherever they show highlight reels, you know, put some doubles stuff in there and then again, like make it fun, like get to know the players, get to interact, you know, see them, you know, in interviews or interact with them doing fun activities. I think that helps build fan base, maybe.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was recently I read an interview with Jamie Murray talking about doubles. I don't know if you saw that. And he said that they had looked at it was either the Instagram feed or the Twitter feed for, it was either like Miami Open, one of the big tournaments. And they looked at every single post to figure out if it's singles or doubles. And it was less than 1% of the posts were about doubles. So
you
it's
know,
like, it's more than 1% of the tournament for sure.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's,
I know. I just, this also kind of thought, just the thought came to me just now, like most club players do like actually primarily play doubles. And that is also a reason I feel like pickleball has been doing so well is that more people feel like it's easily accessible to jump right in and learn how to play. And maybe just not that, you know, it's like doubles and tennis doubles is sometimes easier for people to play, you know, with two people, just having two people on the court and playing in that style. So maybe like also doing more, you know, like outreach, like doubles clinics and stuff, I would think, you know, like, because it's like, if people are primarily playing doubles and then they get to interact with, you know, pro players that are also playing a bunch of doubles and, you know, doing doubles oriented stuff, then, you know, maybe it would make it more, you know, like the more people want to play a sport, the more I think they'll watch it.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, Sophie, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Doubles Only podcast. If you're interested in diving deeper into any topics I discuss, I've created double strategy products that allow me to bring you more podcasts and other doubles content without relying on paid ads. I have ebooks and courses that help you make better strategic decisions during matches and become the smartest player on the court. Go to thetennistribe.com/products to learn more. You can also join my free weekly double strategy newsletter that includes video lessons and more on our homepage. If you want to connect, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or email me directly, will@thetennistribe.com.